Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. Welcome to what is commonly known as Mahaprabhu Das's Car Satsang Center. It is an appropriate name. Mahaprabhu Das. Of course, we are all Mahaprabhu Das. Jiveswaropai Krishnara Nityadas, we're all eternal servants of Krishna. Krishna Chaitanya, Mahaprabhu. But amongst so many Mahaprabhu Dasas here, there is one Mahaprabhu Das who lives just in this building and who got inspired by Srila Prabhupada and Krishna consciousness almost 30 years ago on January 14th, 1978, the Juhu Temple opened and Mahaprabhu Das came for the opening ceremony. So we're less than 2 months away from the 30th anniversary of that historic occasion. And Mahaprabhu Das immediately took up the cause of preaching Krishna consciousness. By profession, he was an advocate. So he began to advocate Krishna consciousness. And he was very successful. Many of the stalwart devotees amongst us, like Radhakrishna Prabhu and Sahadev Prabhu, they were among the early devotees that Mahaprabhu Das cultivated. And after some time, he decided to convert this garage, into a satsang center. And he gave me the honor of inaugurating it. What was the exact date? 24th November, which year? 1979. 24th November. We just passed 24th November. And I would come from time to time and speak, and there would just be a handful of listeners in the audience. Maybe half the garage would be full. I remember once we've almost filled up the whole garage and I was thinking, wow, like we're really spreading here, really growing. Then it came to the stage, few people would be sitting out here, they couldn't quite fit, and now we can see. Of course, this is also the result of many preachers' efforts, but still, as Mahaprabhu Das told me, he knows so many people personally, he could have invited 500 people, but there wouldn't have been space to accommodate them. So things have really grown here. It's very encouraging and gratifying. I had thought to read one or two verses, and I might, but I'm in such a blissful mood being back here and being with all of you. I'm not sure if I will, but I might. I'm reminded of my godbrother, Bharadraj Das. I actually first met Srila Prabhupada in Boston in 1969. And actually the first devotee who spoke to me was Bharadraj Das. Srila Prabhupada had come to give a lecture at the university where I was a student. And at the end of the program, one devotee on the stage announced that if anyone was driving to Cambridge or Boston, please meet the devotees in the foyer because they need a lift. At that time, the Boston Temple didn't have a car. And Brandeis University was in such a place that there was no metro connection. It would have been very complicated. You have to like walk to the village, then get a bus to the train, then take the train. Anyway, I had a car. And I was planning to drive to Cambridge. So I went to the foyer and I met Bharadraj Prabhu. And Bharadraj, he was in such a high mood. He just came up to me and he just started exclaiming the glories of Krishna. He was saying in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna showed his universal form. Mind you, this is the first time I'd ever come to a program. And the universal form was like more brilliant than millions of suns. And when Arjuna saw this universal form, he started to tremble and his hairs were standing on end. And he said, please, Lord Krishna, show me your original form, return to your original form. And then Krishna showed him his four-handed form and then eventually his two-handed form. But this was very intriguing to me. This sounded very intriguing. So anyway, I came to the point that I had a station wagon, and I was going to Cambridge, and I could give a lift to the devotees. So they all packed in. Satsvarupa, Jadarani, Nandakishore, Janava, Saradia, I'm not sure. Yeah, there were basically all the devotees in the Boston Temple. And then there was me and two of my friends. So one of my friends, Gary Prince, from Flatbush, Brooklyn, he was in the back compartment. You know, I think there were maybe only two ladies. Anyway, we let them sit on the seats, and the men crowded into the back compartment. And my friends were sort of spiritual. I was a spiritual seeker. But we were all influenced by impersonalism because pretty much everyone was an impersonalist. So my friend Gary, who had been my roommate, was saying that everything is void. And Satsvarupa was saying there is no void in the creation of God. And I was in the front seat listening to it all, and I guess I was a bit puffed up. So I thought, this is silly the way they're quarreling. I thought I had the answer, so I turned around and I said something which I had read in one of my Zen books. It is not void, and it is not not void, but to give it a name, we call it the void. So to me, that was it. That was the conclusive truth, and there was no need for any further argument. But I don't think it was very convincing, and because they kept on arguing. But meanwhile, I was really, I really was concerned. You know, I really wanted to find perfection. And in the front seat was this lady, Janava, who was the wife of Nanda Kishore. And you know, I was asking her about all these gurus that I was reading about and interested in. So I mentioned, but this is very, anyway, I mentioned one. Is it all right if I use names? Yeah. Yogananda. I mentioned Yogananda because I read Autobiography of a Yogi, and I was like quite enamored of it. She said, oh, Yogananda, he's just a shopkeeper. You go to his ashram in California, and he just keeps everything in stock, whatever you want. You know, you want this yoga, he gives you that. You want that yoga, he gives you that. And he has a statue or a monument to Mahatma Gandhi as a worker for world peace. Everyone knows Mahatma Gandhi wasn't a worker for world peace. He was a nationalist who wanted to drive the British out of India. He doesn't even know who Mahatma Gandhi is. I thought, wow, she's like really powerful. So then I brought up about Zen, because I had been reading books and I'd even gone for a 3-day retreat at Philip Kaplow Zen Center. And Philip Kaplow was like supposed to be a certified, enlightened Zen master, certified by another certified, enlightened Zen master in Japan. So she said, oh, Zen. Zen says that everything is unreal, and in a way it's true. Everything we see is just like images on a screen. But if you pull your consciousness back from the images on the screen, you'll see there's a light. But if you keep following the light further back, you'll find that there's a projector and a projectionist. And I thought, wow, this is like a better explanation of Zen than I'd read in any Zen book. But she went beyond it. Like the light, like it's like it comes to a point, but then there's a person behind it. Ultimately, there's a person behind it. So I thought, she has explained Zen better than anyone in the Zen tradition and gone beyond it. So I thought, You know, there's definitely something very special here. And I knew that she couldn't be speaking with such authority on her own. I mean, she was just a young girl, probably 22 years old, that she couldn't be speaking like this on her own authority. She's getting this power and this knowledge from someone else. And I knew it must be her guru, So like this, we were talking and we got to Harvard Square. And so I let all the devotees out. And after they had gotten out of the car, I realized I didn't know how to find them again. It's like I'd been searching for years. You know, whenever I heard there was a Swami or Yogi, I would go, even if it was 1,000 miles away. And here I felt I'm coming very close. And I let them go, and I didn't know how to find them. So I just parked the car on the side of the roundabout and ran after them. The first devotee I met was the slowest. He was slow, but very deep, very deep. His name was Petit Pavan. Petit Pavan. So I caught up to him. And he was also like in this altered state of higher consciousness, like Bharadraj. He said, "You see all these people here? They're all like sleepwalkers. They're walking, but they don't know who they are or where they're going. They're like sleepwalkers." It's like, everyone was like in this very high transcendental state of consciousness. And I was like so fascinated. I was just listening to him. And then suddenly, it somehow entered in my consciousness, the sound of about 10 or 12 horns honking. I had parked the car in the roundabout, and all the traffic was backed up, and I'd completely forgotten about it. So I said, "Quick, give me the address to the temple. I want to come to the temple." So he gave me the address, and I ran and jumped in the car and relieved the traffic jam. Now, as a reaction, I live in India, and I'm in traffic jams all the time. So this was like leading up to what Bharadraj had said. This is leading up to the conclusion of the introduction. So anyway, I met Prabhupada and I was convinced he was my guru. That's another story. And then I would come every night. And Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Prabhupada would speak in the temple. Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, he would speak outside, usually at a university. And then Sunday was the Sunday program. So when the devotees saw that I was coming every day, because as I mentioned, they didn't have a car. And I think they would, if they couldn't arrange a ride for Prabhupada, they'd just hire a taxi. So they asked me if I would drive him to the programs. I said, "Yeah, okay." So the first day I came to drive him, I came to the temple and it was empty. There was no one there. And I thought, What's happening? Have they left, or is it the wrong day? But then I did meet a devotee, and they explained that Prabhupada had an apartment across the street, and the devotees were with him. And I could also go. So I went in, and there was Prabhupada, and all the devotees were sitting with him. And there was such a mood of affection. It was like a family, like a family. Prabhupada was the father, and the devotees were the children. And anyway, there's so many stories from that period. But later, when I met Bharadraj Prabhu, when we were discussing our meeting of each other then, this was years later, just like a few years ago, he mentioned, it's very interesting because he was also a newer devotee, and when he came down to Boston, it was the first time he ever met Prabhupada. But when I saw him, like to me, they were like all senior devotees. I thought they were like, well, they were pure devotees. So he told me his impression when he first walked into the room and saw Prabhupada with the devotees. He said he had the realization that Krishna consciousness is just love masquerading as a philosophy. That Krishna consciousness is nothing but love, which is masquerading as a philosophy. So I thought of that because being in this loving atmosphere and loving mood, I'm having trouble fixing my mind on the verses that I had chosen to speak on. So I'm justifying that by Bharadraj Prabhu's statement. What I will do is maybe without reading the verses, I will say what I was planning to say. There's a verse in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam in which Lord Krishna says, Yasyaham anugrinami harishye taddanam shanai. That when I am especially mercifully inclined to some devotee, the first thing I do is take away all of his material opulence. Now, this verse is a good verse to discuss with surrendered souls, but most people don't want to hear that if Krishna is especially merciful to them, he'll take away everything from them. And Mahaprabhu Das, when he was preaching, and he was very enthusiastic, he just would try to bring people to the temple and have them take prasad and govindas and maybe meet me. That was his general strategy. But he found there were a lot of people who wouldn't come to the temple. He would say, just come for 5 minutes. Just come for darshan. You don't even have to take prasad. You don't have to meet anyone. Just come and see the deities. And he would say that they wouldn't come. They wouldn't come because they were of the conviction that Krishna consciousness is a one-way street. And once you start on the path, even if you only take one step, you keep going and you can't turn back. And in the end, Krishna will take everything away. So they wouldn't even want to come. They wouldn't want to step foot in the temple because they thought that would be the first step that would lead to the ultimate destruction of their material life. So this was a problem, and it's in the Shastra, and there's so many stories of Krishna taking away the opulence of devotees who are bewildered by their wealth and bringing them to their senses. Like, we recently completed the month of Damodar, and we read the story of Nala Kuvera and Manigriva, the two sons of Kuvera. They were so opulent, but they became intoxicated with their wealth and opulence and material facilities, and therefore they disrespected Narada Muni, and he cursed them to take birth as trees, to stand naked as trees, because they were naked with women, and they were so shameless that even when Narada came, they didn't cover themselves. At least the ladies, they felt some shame and covered themselves, but not these two men. So he cursed them to take birth as trees. But ultimately, the curse of a Vaishnav is a blessing, because in the end, Lord Krishna, in that same Damodar Lila, he pulled the grinding mortar between the twin Arjuna trees, and the trees fell down, and these two effulgent personalities came up. And they had personal darshan of Lord Krishna. So sometimes what appears to be a curse is actually a blessing. And Krishna also, like Narada, he may deprive a devotee of his opulence if the devotee is too intoxicated by the wealth. And then when the devotee becomes humbled by the experience, he comes to his senses and he takes shelter of the devotees of Krishna. And through the association of the devotees of Krishna, they attain the lotus feet of the Lord himself. I'm reminded of one incident after the first Delhi Pandal. Srila Prabhupada was staying in a house, and people were coming to meet him. The Pandal had created a lot of interest. Thousands of people had come every night. And so one of the, there was a young man named Ravi Gupta. He was translating Prabhupada's books into Hindi. And his father is a pious man. He encouraged his son in the translation. So both the father and son came to meet Srila Prabhupada in the house. And Prabhupada asked the father whether he had given up smoking. And the father said, no, Prabhupada. Can't I get some special mercy? And Prabhupada replied, yes, there is special mercy. And then he quoted the verse, yasyaham anugrinami harishye taddanam shanai, that the first installment of Krishna's special mercy is he takes everything away from you. So yes, there is special mercy. Would you like some special mercy? And Mr. Gupta said, no, no, Prabhupada, no. I'll do it myself. Now, there's actually a deep truth to that exchange, that if we have some weakness, and if we make the adjustment or the correction ourselves, that's the best. That's the best. But if we're so attached that we can't do it on our own, then Krishna will intervene and take away that attachment, which is the obstacle in our progress, and that is his mercy. And the devotee accepts it as mercy. The verse says that I take everything away from the devotee, but even after I take it away, he tries to build himself up again. But then I take it away again. And he tries to build himself up again, and I take it away again until he surrenders. So that's actually Krishna's mercy. And it happens to us all the time, maybe not in a drastic way where we, you know, lose our business and our family deserts us, but it happens to us in small ways. Krishna will take something away if we're attached to it in a materialistic way, and the attachment is coming in the way of our service, our preaching. Ultimately, our service is preaching. So the section of the Bhagavatam I was going to speak about was the eighth canto, where Bali Maharaj was so opulent, he had conquered the three worlds, and Krishna came in the form of Vamana to take everything away from him. He came on the plea of begging three steps of land, and Bali Maharaj agreed. And in the end, with two steps, Bali Maharaj covered the upper planetary system and the lower planetary system. In other words, he took everything away with two steps. So then he accused Bali Maharaj that you promised me three steps and you only gave me two. You did not keep your promise, so I'm going to punish you. So he arrested him, he bound him with the ropes of Vasuki, and he, like, humiliated him. Like, he'd already given everything in two steps, but even then, Vamana arrested him and chastised him and humiliated him. And then the Lord spoke. One by one, different people spoke, but in the end, the Lord spoke. And he says that fearful type of statement. I mentioned one by one different devotees and authorities were speaking. So one was Lord Brahma. So in this verse, Canto 8, Chapter 22, Bali Maharaj surrenders his life, text 24. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Brahmanyam Anugrinami, Tadvisho Vidunomyaham, Yanmada Purusha Stabdo, Lokam mam chavamanyate. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, my dear Lord Brahma, because of material opulence, a foolish person becomes dull-witted and mad. Actually, the fifth canto, King Rishabhdev in his instruction says, nunam pramata kurute vikarma, that people become mad with the desire for sense gratification. And in their maddened state, they engage in so many sinful activities. Thus, he has no respect for anyone within the three worlds and defies even my authority. That would also describe Nala Kuvara and Manigriva. To such a person, I show special favor by first taking away all his possessions. So I thought of reading this verse and speaking about it, but I didn't want to put you in too much of a fearful state of consciousness out of affection. So we'll move on to the verse that will be more pleasing. Text 26. Janma karma vayo rupa vidya vaishwarya dandabi yas yasya na bhavet stambas tatrayam mad anugraha. If a human being is born in an aristocratic family or a higher status of life, if he performs wonderful activities, if he is youthful, if he has personal beauty, a good education, and good wealth, and if he is nonetheless not proud of his opulences, it is to be understood that he is especially favored by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The same word, the anugraha, mercy, the same word. So, in the case of Bali Maharaj, although Vamana first took everything away from him, you don't rectify, we're going to take away your cell phone. Although Vamana first took everything away from Bali Maharaj, Bali Maharaj said, you've taken two steps and you've accused me that I haven't fulfilled my promise, but you can keep your third step on my head. In other words, he surrendered. And that is the Lord's purpose. He wants us to surrender because he knows that if we surrender, we'll be happy. Krishna's desire for us to surrender is not because he's lacking one servant and he needs one more servant and he's trying to convince us to surrender so he can get another servant. Krishna's Atmarami, he's self-satisfied. He doesn't need any servants. And besides, Lakshmi Sahasra Sata Sambrahma Sevyamano. He's being served by hundreds of thousands of Lakshmis, gopis. He doesn't need our service, but we need to serve Krishna for our sake, because we can only be happy if we are reinstated in our constitutional positions. Jive Swarupai Krishna Nityadas. So our surrender to Krishna is for our interest, not for any selfish interest of Krishna. So after taking two steps, Bali Maharaj surrendered. And then the Lord, although he was preaching to him, but later he said, actually, my preaching was just a pretense. I was preaching for the sake of others. Actually, you're surrendered. And I'm going to give you your own planet. And not only that, I will personally become your doorman. In other words, the Lord became the servant of his devotee, Bali Maharaj. He gave him his own planet, and he became his servant. And it is said that when Ravana was terrorizing the universe, and he came to Bali Maharaj's planet, he met Vamanadev at the door, and Vamanadev gave him a kick which sent Ravana flying all the way across to the other end of the universe. So, yayatam mam prapadyante, as you surrender to the Lord reciprocates. So Bali Maharaj surrendered, gave everything to the Lord. He gave himself to the Lord. So the Lord gave himself to Bali Maharaj. That's the beautiful reciprocation between the Lord and the devotees. So if you give everything to the Lord gives everything to you. If you give yourself to the Lord gives himself to you. So you're not the loser, but you're the gainer by many times. And that's what people want to be assured of. I mean, many people want to be assured of. When I was preaching, I would often tell the story of Krishna and the fruit vendor. You know the story from the 10th canto that a fruit vendor came to the house of Nanda and Yashoda, and Krishna wanted to buy some fruits. In those days, the system was barter. Actually, Prabhupada said barter is a better system than having gold, and certainly much better than having paper money. But that's also another topic. But the system was barter. And so Krishna went into the house to get some rice. And he filled his hands up with rice to exchange for some fruit. But because his hands were very small and he wasn't used to holding things, so all the rice fell out on the way. There were hardly any grains of rice left. But when he got to the fruit vendor was so charmed by the beauty of Krishna that he or she gave him all the fruit in her basket. She gave him everything. And she was just a fruit vendor. She wasn't like a wealthy person, but she gave everything to Krishna. And Krishna left, and when she looked, her basket, which had been filled by fruit, was now filled by precious gold and jewels and gems. So the idea is that one who gives to Krishna is not the loser, but is the gainer by many times. Our Mahaprabhu Das, he was a lawyer, but he wasn't like one of the most prominent in Bombay. And he never discussed that openly, but I think in a way he sacrificed his business as a lawyer in order to preach and serve the devotees. But somehow, you know, Krishna reciprocated, and I think he's doing pretty well. He doesn't say exactly. That's also Prabhupada's instruction. You shouldn't disclose how much wealth you have, otherwise people will try to take it away from you. But another example, very good example, is Srinath Chidas. Now this is a very interesting story, very instructive story. Srinath Chidas, you know, he was the son of Dharam Singh Desai, who was an industrialist and a member of parliament. And from what I hear, he was quite a shrewd businessman. And I had one friend, Prabhupada had one friend who was like really intelligent, really, he really knew what was going on, what people were thinking, what they were saying. And he would often tell Prabhupada. Anyway, in this case, after Sridharan Singh Desai passed away at a relatively young age, this friend told me the talk about Dr. N.D. Desai. The impression of him was that he was sort of like a Pollyanna, like a good person who wasn't really fit to deal with the material world. So people in the business community were concerned that now that the father had left at a relatively young age, like they didn't know how the businesses would go on with this young, they thought, like this young starry-eyed devotee. So some time passed, a little time passed, and I would visit Srinath Ji Das at his home, and he was very strict in his morning program. He would get up, he would do his worship, he would chant his rounds, and he was very serious. Like one morning I came early, I could see the whole atmosphere in the house was very sanctified, very pure and very serious in a Krishna conscious way. And he was sitting on his chair or sofa. It's nice furniture, but he was just sitting very attentive and he was chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare. He would also walk at Seaface Park and chant his rounds in the morning. So this one morning I came early, and he was like very intent in his chanting. And he was saying that he felt that the strength of his morning program was the key to his success in his business. Because by that chanting in the early morning, his mind became very clear. And Krishna gave him the intelligence how to conduct the business successfully. So that struck me. After some time, he brought out a new line. Tube lights, or light bulbs, SEMA. And he had quite a massive advertising campaign. All over Bombay you'd see the billboards for SEMA. I didn't know it was his company. And I would look at these billboards, and there was something very attractive about them. I mean, usually I try not to look at the billboards. Not very successful at it, but, and I must say the billboards then were more wholesome than the ones now. But anyway, I was something, the word SEMA and then the tube and something about the colors, it was just like a very attractive billboard. And then I found out it was Srinath Ji Das's. And then I had this realization. There's two ways of looking at it, but I looked at it more the second way. The first way was that Krishna gave him the intelligence how to do it. But it was more than that. I feel that Krishna in the heart was attracting people to the SEMA lights. You know, and then I had this realization that, you know, Krishna's in Srinath Ji Das's heart. He's giving him the intelligence how to do the business. And he's also in the hearts of the potential customers. And he can also inspire them within the heart. This is a good light. You should get SEMA light. And out of the profits of the business, Srinathji was able to give more Lakshmi to Narayan. You know, he was able to give more money in the service of the Lord. So that is the Lord's real mercy. I mean, the first is also the Lord's mercy. If someone is too attached to make advancement, Krishna takes away the attachment until the devotee can fully surrender. But when the devotee is fully surrendered, Krishna can give him everything. And he'll know that the devotee will use it in Krishna's service. And that's the Lord's real mercy. Srila Prabhupada quoted the same verse, Yasyaham Anugrinami, in relation to himself. Prabhupada himself had been a successful businessman. In fact, there were predictions that he would become the richest man in India. But then, like, everything started to go wrong in his business. You know, his own workers, ransacked his office and stole his papers and stock, and it's like everything was going wrong. And then he came across this verse, Yasyaham Anugrinami Harishe Tadanam Shanai. He thought, maybe this is what Krishna's doing with me. Maybe he's taking everything away. And eventually Prabhupada, in his own words, not just in his own words, but he entered the Vanaprastha ashram and ultimately took sannyas. And then he said that when he took sannyas, he was fully ready to discharge the order of his spiritual master and preach. And later he commented that in the beginning, Krishna tested me by taking everything away. And later, Krishna tested me by giving me everything. Both are tests. Both are tests. The ultimate test is, are we going to remember Krishna or not? Are we going to surrender to Krishna or not? So, if Krishna takes something away from us, are we going to chase after that thing that he took away? Or are we going to take shelter of him? Or if Krishna gives us something, are we going to try to enjoy that thing that Krishna gave us? Or are we going to take shelter of him and use it in his service? So that test is always there, moment to moment, because we're not in the mood of artificial renunciation. We're in the mood of yukta vairagya. Everything belongs to Krishna, so everything should be used in Krishna's service to preach. So we're always being tested. Is this facility that's being given to me, am I using it in Krishna's service to spread Krishna consciousness, or am I trying to enjoy it for myself? And we may find there's some mixture. So we don't necessarily have to renounce the thing, but we have to purify our hearts by chanting and hearing Chaito Darpano Marjanam, Shrinvata Svakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtanam. We always have to chant and hear to keep our hearts cleansed of those desires to enjoy in a selfish way. And then whatever facility we get, we can actually use in Krishna's service without attachment, anasaktasya vishayan. So that is our goal. That is pure devotional service. Srila Prabhupada said it's a very fine line. If we try to enjoy something that's meant for Krishna's service, that's That's boga. That's wrong. But if we renounce something that could be used in Krishna's service because we don't want to become entangled, that's also wrong. That's phalgu vairagya. So it's a very fine line. Anasaktasya vishayan. We deal with the objects of the senses, but without attachment. And we accept them in an appropriate way. Yukta vairagya is sometimes translated as appropriate renunciation. Appropriate renunciation means that we engage everything in the service of Krishna, who is the proprietor of everything. Even our own bodies, our senses, they belong to Krishna. And so bhakti means sarvopadi vinirmuktam tat paritvena nirmalam rishikena rishikesha sevanam bhakti ruchate. That we engage the senses, rishik, engage the senses in the service of the owner of the senses or the controller of the senses, rishikesh, rishikena by the senses, rishikesha sevanam. We engage in the service of Rishikesh, who's the meant to be the controller of the senses, who's the proprietor of the senses. And Srila Prabhupada said, a pure devotee never engages any of his senses without first taking permission from Krishna. Because they're not his. This very body, the senses of this body are not ours. They belong to Krishna. So we can't do anything with them without Krishna's permission. So that is bhakti. That is bhakti. And that is the platform on which we are meant to act. And that can be achieved by associating with devotees, sadhu sangha, and hearing and chanting in their association. And that is the purpose of satsang. Sat means that which is eternal. And sangha means association. So sat sangha means to associate that which is eternal. So Krishna is eternal. The truth of Krishna consciousness is eternal. And the devotees who serve Krishna, they're also called sat. Because by association with the sat, they become sat. So satsang, this is most important. And therefore we have this satsang center, many satsang centers. We have temples for satsang, to associate with sat, with the eternal truth of Krishna consciousness, with the absolute truth who is Krishna, and with the devotees who speak the truth and serve the truth. And this will elevate us beyond this duality of renouncing and enjoying. Actually, we're not into either renouncing or enjoying. We're into service. Srila Prabhupada said that once he actually asked his guru Maharaj about this boga and tyaga, because amongst Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's followers, we find different examples. Rupa Goswami, he gave up everything and was living as a mendicant in Vrindavan. But Ramananda Rai, he was living as the governor of Madras. Very opulent position. So Prabhupada asked about this boga and tyaga. And his Guru Maharaj gave such a brilliant answer, as we would expect. He gave the example of a wife. In the traditional Vedic system, when the husband leaves home the wife, it's called Swadrin Bratrika, the wife dresses in very simple cloth, like very simple white cloth. She doesn't bathe, she doesn't comb her hair, she doesn't decorate herself. She just lies down on a mat on the floor. She doesn't enjoy any of the facilities in the household. But when her husband comes home, you like this? But when the husband comes home, the same wife will bathe very nicely. She'll like anoint her body with oils. She'll wear, you know, beautiful saris and decorate herself with ornaments and jewelry, and you know, comb her hair very nicely, put flowers. So the two seem very different. But actually, in both cases, the goal is the same. The goal is to serve the husband and please the husband. So Bhog and Tyag are like that in a pure devotee. Rupa Goswami, he could leave everything for the pleasure of the Lord. And Ramananda Rai, he could accept everything for the pleasure of the Lord. But in both cases, the only goal was to please the Lord. And therefore, that difference of bhoga and tyaga, or being materially impoverished or materially opulent, are superficial. They really don't affect the heart of a devotee. Within his heart, the devotee wants only to please the Lord. And if it means living in an impoverished condition, he will accept it. It means living in an opulent position, he will accept it. And he's happy in both cases. And Srila Prabhupada, even though Krishna gave him everything, he actually didn't like, in a personal sense, he didn't like all the opulence. In Mayapur, they've kept it. He was living in a grass hut. He was living in a grass hut. And then they built, like, in those days it would be called a marble palace, the lotus building. It had wide verandas covered with marble. And it was very opulent. It was by far the biggest and most opulent building in Mayapur at the time. And Prabhupada, he didn't want to move into the new place. He wanted to stay in the grass hut. Then finally the devotee said, my grass hut is in the mode of goodness. That marble palace is in the mode of passion. I want to stay in my grass hut. And the devotees were saying, you know, about his comforts and this and that, and he didn't want to hear it. But then one of the disciples said, but Srila Prabhupada, if you stay in the grass hut, people won't come and hear you speak. If you move into the what they were calling the marble palace, people will come and hear you. And Prabhupada said, then I will move. Then I will move. Not because he wanted to enjoy the marble floors. And he said that in previous ages, people were so pious that a saintly person could live in a cave and people would come to hear him speak. But now people are so fallen, they don't have that spiritual acumen. So unless we give them nice facilities, they won't come. Therefore, we have to provide nice facilities so they'll come and hear. And that's our ultimate goal, that they should hear. Satam prasanga mama virya samvita. By associating with devotees and hearing the absolute truth from the mouths of the pure devotees, they can become devotees and go back home, back to Godhead.
and that is our only concern. And so, Mahaprabhu Das, we don't even know now, we are so delirious, we don't know who's living in a palace and who's living in a hut. Because there is no palace and there's no hut. There's only Krishna consciousness, the spiritual world. When Srila Prabhupada entered his quarters in Los Angeles, I don't know if any of you have seen, but if you go there, you should see. But at the time, they were by... It was like an apartment. Prabhupada never had like his own place before. But when we bought the church in Los Angeles, he got his own place. And, you know, when he walked into it for the first time with his servant, Brahmananda Swami, Brahmananda said, "Prabhupada, this is like heaven." And Prabhupada said, "What heaven? This is Vaikuntha." So we are not any devotee's house. It's not a hut. It's not a palace. It's not Bhoga, it's not Tyaga, it's Vaikuntha, the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan. And that is the satsang we desire, and that is why we are here. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Vrindavananta Bharata ki jai. Mahaprabhu says we should take questions. Are you saying you have a question or just general call for questions? All right, general call for questions. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Mahaprabhu Das can start. You started it, so you should continue to start it.
Maharaj, I was reading book of Black Lotus. It's fantastic. I can't leave that book after coming from Mayapur. It's reading. And... I'm not asking that question, but somehow or other, that particular way of Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was saying, if Srila Prabhupada will ask me, have you control over sex? Though it's not nothing to do with the, at this time, but I'm connecting it, the question. That, and he will ask me, I will say, Prabhupada, I have made so many temples. Then he'll say, have you control over your sex desire? Prabhupada, I will say, Prabhupada, I have made so many devotees. Then Prabhupada will ask me, have you control sex? 20 times in that page, 10 times Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj is writing. Prabhupada will ask me this question, and I will reply like this. And very great, gravely, I could not get the answer what actually meaning by that he's asking. I'm completely confused that what that mean having control when he's asking a person of Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. Such a great devotee, and he's feeling in that way. Then, where is our position? Somebody may say, "Well, he's a sannyasi, guru, GVC, great devotee," and We may be living in Vanprastha Ashram for 10, 15 years. But what is the meaning of that? In the same way, what is the meaning? Have we control over the desire for greed? These are things which are very difficult to understand. Both the things. When he himself is very confused on that point, I could not get understand that. And the same thing comes, this greed, there is no end of it. And we may feel sometimes that we earn and I can use in the service of the Lord, but actually it's not for the service of the Lord. So if I can get some light on this.
Mahaprabhu Das has asked a very intelligent and pertinent question. You're not speaking. He got the biography of His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami in Mayapur called Black Lotus, and he's been reading it. And I believe he's referring to a Vyas Puja offering that Maharaj wrote, in which he imagined coming before Srila Prabhupada and reciting different things. I did open so many temples, made so many devotees, and Prabhupada asking him, "Are you free from sex desire?" Now, as one, and Mahaprabhu is sort of suggesting that Maharaj was, I don't know, maybe confused about this point. Now, as one advances, one becomes more humble. And I wouldn't, but so there's like sort of a subjective way and an objective way of seeing this. Certainly, you know, as a sannyasi and as a devotee, Bhakti Tirtha Swami was exemplary. But still, within himself, he could feel that there's some subtle desire. And he's not satisfied. He's feeling like coming before Srila Prabhupada, he's not satisfied. But I did all these things, but am I completely free from sex desire? So Mahaprabhu is asking, what does it mean to be completely free from sex desire? Yeah, there are different levels. I mean, first is just to control our senses. That's the main thing, and especially in Kali Yuga. Prabhupada said the atmosphere in Kali Yuga is so contaminated that it's hard to avoid thinking of it. But if at least you can control it and not actually indulge in it, then, you know, it's okay. But as one advances, he doesn't want anything to come between him and Krishna. He doesn't want any unwanted thought or desire to come in between him and Krishna. And something that to an ordinary person would be small, a very small defect, as the devotee becomes more and more pure, to the devotee it becomes a bigger and bigger defect. And that's where the sense of humility comes. There's one verse that forgetfulness of Krishna for even one moment is the greatest anomaly, the greatest calamity. So for a pure devotee to forget Krishna even for one moment, it's like a calamity. So he doesn't want any obstacle, any stray thought or desire. But when an advanced devotee speaks in that way, we shouldn't misunderstand that he's struggling on the same level that we are. You know, But our process, you know, again, our process is the same. Basically, you know, Chaito Darpano Marjanam, hearing and chanting. It's not like an impersonal attempt to like rid the mind of thoughts and desires, but it's personal. We're hearing about Krishna, chanting about Krishna, serving Krishna, praying for Krishna's mercy, that we can become completely pure and eligible to serve him with love. Then Mahaprabhu related the same question to greed, that we want more and more and more. And we may say we want it for Krishna's service, but there could be some duplicity there. Usually there is some duplicity. I heard a tape of Srila Prabhupada just 2 days ago where he was talking about the exploitative mentality, that you're a businessman, that's all right, you have to earn a livelihood, you're a businessman. But if you have a very cunning, exploitative mentality, like how to get people's, how to exploit people, how to take advantage of them. They could be your workers, they could be your customers, you know. Then that mood, you know, you may get money, but you lose Krishna. You know, you lose the chance for Krishna consciousness. It's a very powerful lecture, a very powerful lecture. So that mood of exploiting others, accumulating more, that mood is very much against bhakti. It's one of the six things, atyahara prayasascha, prajalpa niyamagraha, one of the things that destroys bhakti is over-endeavoring for material things. Also overeating or over-accumulating. Sadbi bhakti pranashyati, they destroy bhakti. So, you know, it's a matter of purification, it's a matter of sincerity. It's also a matter of associating with pure devotees. The more you associate with pure devotees, in the mood of yourself becoming purified. We chant, but we can chant with in different moods, you know. But we should have the mood that we want to become purified. Someone can chant with the mood of increasing his material opulence, you know. There, one can chant in that, but we should chant in the mood of becoming purified so we can serve Krishna better. Srila Prabhupada said the chanting is like we're praying, O Lord, O energy of the Lord, please engage me in your service. So if that's our desire to serve Krishna, and if we're sincere in our chanting, then he'll fulfill our desire. But if it's mixed, like we want to serve Krishna, we don't want to be sinful because we don't want to go to hell and be punished, but at the same time, we want to hold on, you know, keep our pile very nicely, and it is an impediment. It's an impediment. And greed is a big impediment. And just to show you how it works on every level, that there's no end to it. At one time, John Paul Getty was considered the wealthiest man in the world. And some newspaper reporters asked him, you know, what is your philosophy of life in one word? I can tell you my philosophy of life in one word. More. He already was the richest man in the world, but he wanted more. And they also asked him, you're the richest man in the world, you have, you know, anything that money could buy. What do you think about in your solitary moments when you're all alone and there's no one with you, nothing to do? What do you think about? And he replied, how to pay the bills. Like a poor man, he might be thinking, how can I get 1,000 rupees to pay the rent? And a rich man can be thinking, how can I get $1 billion to buy out this company, or, you know, secure my control of the company? But the mentality is the same. There's no difference. There's no difference. And as Prabhupada mentioned many times, and in the lecture that I heard the other day, whether you're a rich man or a poor man, how many chapatis can you eat? You know, you might have 100 rupees, you can only eat 2 or 4 chapatis. And you might have 100 crores, you can still only eat 2 or 4 chapatis. And as far as the miseries of material existence, janma, mritu, jara, vyadi, birth, disease, old age, and death, they'll affect you the same way, whether you have 100 rupees or 100 crores. You're going to still suffer disease, you're still going to grow old, you're still going to die. So what are you doing it all for? What are you doing it all for? I don't think there are many people who can say that they're doing it all for Krishna. If someone can say they're doing it 50% for Krishna, that's very good. And that's acceptable. That's acceptable. That's grihastha ashram. There's different rules for different ashrams, and that's acceptable for grihastha ashram. That's good. And that's worthy. But just gathering more and more and offering a little to Krishna. Prabhupada would quote the verse, patram pushpam phalam toyam yome bhakta prayachiti, that if you offer with love and devotion a leaf, a fruit, and some water, I will accept it. So Prabhupada says that that verse is spoken by Krishna to say that anyone can serve him. Even the poorest person, patram, a leaf, tulsi leaf. The other day we were passing some chawals, I forget that area, maybe Dadar, very poor. But I saw every balcony there was a tulsi. I was like so impressed. They're like so poor, but every balcony there is a tulsi. So patram, a leaf, pushpam, a flower, phalam, some fruit, toyam, some water. Anyone, even the poorest person, can offer these. But Prabhupada said it's not that you think, okay, let me keep crores of rupees under my mattress and I'll offer Krishna putram pushpam phalam toyam and keep the rest for myself. You should serve according to your capacity. In fact, that's one of the items of devotional service in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. One should celebrate the glories of the Lord according to one's means. But anyway, it's a very good question. It's a very good question because it's something we all deal with. We all deal with it. But again, we have, what can we do? Chant the holy name, take shelter of pure devotees. But in the mood, of becoming purified. If we enter in an open-hearted mood to the Holy Name, please save me, you know. You know, please save me. Then the Holy Name will do its magic. The pure devotees will do their magic. But if we're out externally, we're making a show, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I think His Holiness Sridhar Swami used to say that externally they're chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, but internally they're thinking rupiah, rupiah, paisa, paisa. Not like that. We have to be free from duplicity, sat, truthful devotee, no duplicity. Yes.
Thank you for a wonderful answer, Maharaj. You quoted Sridhar Maharaj regarding chanting, that how while chanting one may be meditating on rupiah and paisa. Very often we may be given a service or even the simple service of chanting. We try to start off contemplating on the philosophy and try to have a pure desire. But because of lifetimes of conditioning, there is always a fruitive mentality. Whether it's a as a service, as a leader, as a preacher, as all, or a book distributor, or simple chanting, there's a fruitive mentality which creeps in. Sometimes we are suddenly caught unaware, and then we may even start justifying our activities as spiritual because we are driven by the fruitive motives. For example, if you are in a leadership position, you start justifying, and you want, and the main motive is getting more honor and prestige, recognition. How to guard against this?
Well, that's a good question. That we chant, we want to chant purely to become purified, so we can chant purely. But because we're so conditioned, we have a fruitive mentality of doing service and getting the fruits for ourselves. And everything is always a dual process. The internal process is hearing and chanting and remembering Krishna. And the external process is engaging everything in Krishna's service. So, okay, that fruitive mentality is there to get some fruit. So we don't want that. By hearing and chanting without offense, with attention, that will be purified, ceto darpano marginam. But at the same time we get the fruit, we should give it to Krishna. I heard there's a saying, all Lakshmi should be given to Narayan. All women should be given to Krishna, and all credit should be given to Guru. But whatever it is, we shouldn't keep it. Prabhupada told the story of the party of pilgrims. They were going on a yatra by train. And it was an overnight train, and the next morning when they woke up, everyone found that their shoes were stolen in the night. So they're all very upset. So there's a big commotion and looking here and there, and eventually they found all the shoes. They actually hadn't been stolen, but they'd been moved from one place to another. And then one of the pilgrims admitted that previously he had been a thief and he used to steal people's shoes. So in the middle of the night, because of that habit, he couldn't control himself, so he just had to take the shoes and do something with them. But because he was, you know, becoming a devotee and trying to become purified, he didn't actually steal them, but he just kept them in different places. So, you know, because of habit, we may do things that we're just accustomed to doing, but because we're devotees, we try to make it more innocuous, you know, by, you know, ultimately giving it to Krishna, or at least not doing the worst and gradually doing the best with it. So both external and external, we have to do those, make those efforts.
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much for a wonderful class, Maharaj. I wanted to understand, we see in many of the pastimes that by the will of the Lord, Jay and Vijay could not recognize the four Kumaras, and how Brahmaji could not understand the cowherd boy playing with the boys and the cows and committing something which seems like an offense. And on the other side, we see Mother Yashoda being covered by Yoga Maya and not recognizing that he is the Supreme Lord and preparing butter for him or running after him, that he is stealing butter. And on the other side, Krishna tells Arjun that I remember all the lifetimes that we have spent, both you and I, but you don't remember, but I remember everything. And he knows even the future. And then how does Krishna still enjoy the pastimes? Like when he appeared as Narsingadev out of the pillar, he knew that he is going to kill Hiranyakashipu and he is going to save Prahlad. Then how does he get the rasas when he knows everything is orchestrated by him? Then how he gets the fun out of it?
Very good question. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Yeya tam mam prapadyante tam stataiva bhajamyam, that as they surrender to me, I reciprocate. So Krishna, because of Mother Yashoda's intense love for Krishna as a mother, Krishna actually reciprocates and feels like a son. Because of Mother Yashoda's intense desire to feed Krishna her breast milk, Krishna actually becomes hungry. Although he's Atmarama, he's completely self-satisfied. So Chaitanya Charitamrita explains that not only do Krishna's devotees in Vrindavan come under Yoga Maya, but Krishna himself comes under Yoga Maya. Mother Yashoda forgets that Krishna is God, otherwise how could she treat him like her dependent son? But Krishna also forgets that he's God. And so when Mother Yashoda takes up the stick, he actually feels afraid. He's not pretending, he actually feels afraid. So you might say, well, what will happen to the universe if Krishna forgets he's God? And that's a good question. So our acharyas, like Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, have explained that Krishna has many potencies, all of whom act for Krishna's pleasure. They know what Krishna's purpose is, and they act in Krishna's service. So, by the influence of Yoga Maya, Krishna forgets he's God. He's playing with the cowherd boys. They're all playing like equals. They're wrestling. They're playing sports. Sometimes Krishna's defeated, and he has to carry the victor on his shoulders. He forgets he's God. But then there's a forest fire, and all the cowherd boys are approaching him. Now, if Krishna were to say, hey, look, I'm just like one of you guys. Don't look at me. What would happen? It'd be a disaster. So Yoga Maya, I mean, there are different potencies, but in a broad sense, we say Yoga Maya. So Yoga Maya, knowing that Krishna's ultimate purpose is to please his devotees, so she makes him forget that he's God in order so that he can have pleasing relationships and Sakya Ras and Vasalya Ras and so on. But when required, she reminds him that he's God, also for the sake of his pastimes with his devotees. So he swallows the forest fire. He expands himself into a duplicate set of cowherd boys and calves. But when that specific purpose is fulfilled, Yogamaya again, to facilitate his service, his reciprocation with his devotees, she again makes him forget he's God, and they forget he's God, and they enjoy in that sweet mellow of Vraja Ras. All right, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.